Once again, my guests, Richard C. Hoagland and David Wilcock. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program. All right, look, I do want to get off a little bit on what we had, what we were going to discuss. Strangely, in a lot of ways, it doesn't, it's not that far off the mark anyway.
It's absolutely incredibly on point.
It really is. Yeah, here's what I want, Richard. Look,
okay.
We've got a neighborhood. We're Earth. We can look at Mars, and we're looking very hard at Mars now. You know what, Richard? There's something else I want to settle just before we even get into all of this, and that is for a few weeks or months now, the audience has featured or believes that we have a feud going on. And it's not true. At least I don't think it's true. Not on my part. What
not
I did do,
either.
I went on the air and said, with regard to some photographs that had gone up, that, you know what? I'm sorry, I see rocks. And then I hadn't heard from you in a while. And, you know, two-dimensional me, I'm not changing that. Some of the things that you pointed out is possibly, I don't know, the various different artifacts that
junk.
You see. I don't see the same junk. I see rocks. And I still just see rocks. But we have had no feud that I'm aware of going on. I'm sure word of my saying that reached you.
Yes,
but,
did.
But then again, that's not really anything new between
but
us.
Art, just because you remember what you told me the night the first image of the face on Mars, full face, came in?
Yes.
In 2001?
I'm not talking about the face now.
I know,
but yes.
Remember what you told me?
Yes.
You know, you said hang it up, get another job, go into storm windows.
Oh,
it's
you mean,
over?
Well, you mean the cat box picture?
No, this was the one in 2001, the full face image. I can play the tape.
Well, okay. That may well be too.
In a reasoned reconsideration, going back and looking and thinking, you came around to the other night I heard you say, the damn thing is cat-like on the one side and monkey-like on the other.
Yeah, that's right.
It only took you 3 years, Art. So I'm a very patient person. You know, I figure if you can't see what I see as soon as I see it, just give you time. All right.
So anyway, so they know there was no feud.
No, there are people out there that I'm sure would love to create a feud.
Yeah, they always do that.
You know?
But it just hasn't happened.
And when David and I cooked up this little thing we're going to do tonight, the first person I picked up the phone and called was you, because you and I started this on the air many, many years ago, discussing the backdrop to the new physics that Gene Maloff gave his life for, which is a complete revolution in the paradigm that is not being discussed in any mainstream halls, any mainstream venues. In fact, what I like to do to kind of intro this section of the program tonight is to read a short section, and I know you hate reading, but...
Yeah, I do, and I just want to set this up, and I started to.
Well, let me tell you what I wanted to read, and then you can decide.
Yes.
This is Gene's last editorial, which is so incredibly prescient. It's almost like he knew he wasn't going to be with us.
Read it.
And I'm sitting here holding it in my lap, reading it again.
Go ahead and read it.
For the second time.
Right, just do it.
Okay. He calls it Breakthrough, Science Censorship, the Invisible Evil. The Spirit and Opportunity rovers on Mars have left their landing cocoons and are exploring the surface of an alien world that has been long captivating the human imagination. The robotic laboratories are sending back spectacular imagery and other data, which, thanks to the Internet, give scientists and laypeople around the world an unprecedented chance to explore vicariously another planet. There is no doubt that this is a huge accomplishment. It demonstrates progress in technological sophistication, in astronautics, communications, computer technology, and robotics, applied toward valuable ends to learn about another world by touching it from afar. The success of the latest Martian initiative might suggest to some that all is well in the halls of science. Everything is working as planned. New vistas are opening up. We may soon be confronted with further evidence that Mars harbors some kind of life, or perhaps once had living things that left remains.
Mm-hmm.
Science has triumphed. We are collectively experiencing the fruits of over four centuries of revolutionary scientific progress. There appears to be no obvious evidence of science censorship in these missions. Everyone gets to see pretty much all the data all at once in nearly real time. Wonderful. But beneath this triumph of the extension of human exploration stands another reality about science, one that is not pleasant to contemplate. Just at this moment of success, for those of us who most of our lives have dreamed of Martian vistas opening up, we are now all too aware of how much more human beings would be accomplishing at this time, and how fantastically better off civilization would be were we allowed to use collectively all of our faculties and powers of reason. But isn't science supposed to be one of the most liberating endeavors? How can I claim that we are not being allowed to use all our faculties and powers toward making a better world? Easy. If there is even one choke point at which such appropriate information about scientific discoveries is withheld or diminished, the community of scientists and the supportive citizenry who fund their work publicly and privately are defrauded. Sadly, today, such a choke point exists. It is the routine censoring of scientific information that does not conform to dominant scientific paradigms of the day.
That's Eugene Melov, brutally...
And then he went on to detail what exactly he was talking about.
Brutally murdered today in Connecticut. All right, Richard. We are exploring Mars. We ultimately will explore our other planets. We have neighbors. They are these planets that we can look to. If we're trying to figure out what might happen to Earth, or what has happened to Earth, or even how we got here, the whole mess, then we've got to study our neighbors. And as we study our neighbors, we come to certain conclusions. And I think that's kind of the center of where we are tonight. What is it that we know about Mars or any of our other planets, our close neighbors, that gives us clues about our own situation?
Well, the thing that brought Gene and me together and David Wilcock is a kind of a common thread, which is exploration on the cutting edge of the unknown. When we tripped over the Cydonia problem, you know, two decades ago, and tried to unravel, you know, if it was real and then what did it mean, one of the key things that I figured out with the help of Errol Turin and some other folks is that there appeared to be a message left in the ruins of an ancient Martian civilization at a place called Cydonia on Mars. And that message had to do with the underpinnings of reality, how physics really works, what relates us as conscious beings on this planet mm-hmm. to stars, the galaxy, energy processes, possible technologies that don't use oil. The whole nine yards appeared to be in those geometric formation.
How do you get that out of that, Richard? How do you get from there to there? In
okay.
other words, if you would.
Well, in the simplest possible nutshell, we found that the structures around the face on Mars were not in random order. They appeared to have a very precise geometric pattern.
Meaning
they were laid out.
I understand that. Meaning what, though?
Well, what we then discovered was this geometry was not just any old geometry, but appeared to be a geometry that was the underpinnings of physics in the 19th century. And that physics talked not about quantas and, you know, zero-point energy and things that go bump in the night that can't be measured, like, you know, Einstein number of dimensions that can never be tested. It talked about higher dimensions that could be tested, where energy could flow from higher dimensions into our dimension and literally create all of the reality that we see.
Well, that's pretty wild, but I don't understand what in the geometry, I don't understand what in the geometry tells you that story.
That's where things get complicated, and that's where websites come in and books and 20 years of teaching people. So I don't want to, you know, we can do that as we go through this set of examples of things we're finding in the solar system now. I don't want to bog down people with a tutorial, all right? I want to get to the good
stuff.
But
that's an incredible statement to make.
Well,
its face.
The incredible part of the statement is that the same geometry that mathematicians and physicists were working with, leading to higher dimensional possibilities, people like Riemann back in the 19th century, is the same geometry we found apparently encoded in the set of ruins on the planet Mars. That's why I have said for a long time, Art, that I would be willing to bet anybody anything that this is real.
David, how do you fit into this at this point? I mean, where do you fit in here?
Well, here's a kid 19 years old who reads Monuments of Mars and has his world completely turned upside down because everything that he'd taken to be reality is suddenly called into question. There is a series of relationships between clearly artificial monuments on the Cydonia Plateau,
right,
which demonstrate angular relationships, certain specific angles such as 19.5 degrees, and those angles correspond to a particular form of geometry. So I spent years and years of my life with, at the forefront of my mind, Hoagland's model, thinking about how geometry could be affecting planets. Because the basic bottom line...
Let's tell everybody a little bit about 19.5. There is something that anybody can demonstrate to themselves, and that is that at about the 19.5 degree point on either side of center of a planet, you can observe very unusual things, evidence of energy within the planets at that 19.5 degree point. Is that accurate?
Absolutely.
It goes all the way from the sun through all the solid planets, the ones that, you know, like Earth that we live on, or Mars, to the big gas giant planets like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. You find the largest energy upwelling on these planets at 19.5 degrees.
Which is this hyperdimensional point that you're always telling us about, and you believe a source of energy for not just our planet but all planets.
Well,
right?
It wasn't a matter of belief. It was when we saw this geometry, this pattern. Remember, all science starts with just seeing a pattern.
Yes.
Then we started asking questions of people that I knew, experts in various fields. What did this pattern mean? Did anybody ever notice this pattern anywhere before? And it was my friend Stan Tennant at the Meru Foundation, you know, who's been working on biblical texts for years and years.
Yes.
Who said, oh, that pattern is found in Coxeter and several other eminent mathematicians, and it relates to hyperdimensional models, models of higher state spaces, higher realities that cannot be seen or touched or tasted, but can be modeled mathematically as an abstract theory, and had been used as part of the cornerstone of 19th century physics, when physics was just being born by giants like Faraday and others.
Is it your position, Richard, that the energy at this point, this hyperdimensional point that you're always talking about,
mm-hmm.
Is the source energy of much of the so-called free energy tapping?
That's what brought us and Gene together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because when I laid out my take on this, and he came at it from 20th century physics, and he began to see more and more anomalies. That was the beginning of our conversation, because what I said to him point blank one day was, Gene, I don't think cold fusion is fusion at all. I think it is something different, something more fundamental, something revolutionary, something potentially hyperdimensional, something that is transmitted from another dimension and appears in our dimension as an anomalous energy source under certain conditions.
But people can see this, is what I'm trying to get through to them. If you look at the 19.5 place on a planet,
yep.
That much is obvious.
Oh, yeah.
And
any
confirmed...
planet, just go look at a map of the planets. Go to NASA's website and download some of those stunning globes.
Right. I take it this hit you as well, David, reality.
You look on Venus, you have these two volcanoes at 19.5. You look on Mars, you got Olympus Mons, three times the size of Mount Everest, which is not only at 19.5, but it's precisely 120 degrees west of the face. And 120 degrees is exactly where the other tip of the tetrahedron would be.
It's more of the same geometry.
Yeah, and then it goes on to the great red spot on Jupiter, which has been stable for at least 300 years. Uranus has a great dark spot.
Yeah, all of this is true, folks. Check it out yourself. So there is something special about that.
And in the solar cycle, the 11-year solar cycle that you're so in love with, Art?
Well, it's a love-hate relationship,
that's right.
Richard.
Okay. I found years ago in an old Scientific American, one of the key solar experts, a guy named Parker, who published that the peak latitude of sunspots, when the cycle peaks every 11 years plus or minus,
mm-hmm.
19.5 degrees. Then I found people, I started talking about this on the air, you know, on your show and other shows, sending me little technical papers. Like, we have an electrojet phenomenon that atmospheric scientists, upper atmosphere scientists at NASA at Goddard have been watching for years. Guess where the electrojets are marking, you know, like, they're like super altitude jet streams, except they're electrified. 19.5 degrees north and south. More and more and more examples of this, you know, coming up over and over again, to where I finally said, okay, this has got to be where we went wrong. 19th century physics somehow got suborned. We took the wrong path, and we went down the left road in the canyon instead of the right road out to the plane. If the 19th century physicists had stayed on course, stayed the course, as George Bush Sr. would say,
mm-hmm.
we would have free energy today. We would not have our guys and women dying in Iraq. We would not have Bin Laden at our doorstep. The World Trade Towers would still exist. They might be five times taller and made out of amazing materials, because with this kind of energy, you can do astonishing technological things. We would probably have a garden on Earth. We would probably, you know, be able to feed everybody that's here and those that are coming. In other words, it's the kind of vision that Mayoff had, that the new energy age, when people embrace the real physics and applied it to a real technology that liberate us from this albatross of oil, could give to every human being on this planet. And what astonished me, and, you know, was part of our discussion for years and years and years, as he fought me that we had found the keys to this in a bunch of ruins on another planet, to my intense gratification, the day that I talked to Gene, 2-3 days before he died, he acknowledged to me that Cydonia is real, they're about to announce life on Mars, and the physics that I've been talking about as behind the free energy technologies that he has on tap is probably what's causing it to work.
All right. Both of you hold on. God knows the world does need a very fast change, doesn't it? I think everybody out there sort of knows that. In the pit of their stomach, in your gut, you know it, right? That we've got to initiate a change, and that it's got to come very, very soon. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. At one moment, there is something very mysterious about all of these things on all of these planets. And by the way, even the Sun, I believe, at 19.5, and even our own Earth. Is that correct, Richard? What do we have at 19.5 here on Earth that would be...
Well, Hawaii. We have the Big Island and the big volcano on Hawaii, which is analogous to Olympus Mons on Mars.
So you're saying the energy is being
dispersed?
There is
an upwelling. There is a plume of lava.
Yes.
Because we're on Earth, we got ground truth. We can measure this.
What about 19.5? Everybody knows about Hawaii. As you continue around the world, are there more remarkable?
Well, no, because what happens is you get a consolidation of the energy upwellings in a physical form, like a vortex or a volcano, into one biggie. But if you look at earthquake data, seismic data, we know that there's a plume of hot lava coming up from the outer core of the Earth, 1,800 miles straight up under Hawaii. And this plume of energy is like an arrow coming up from the core of the Earth, bursting through the crust at 19.5. And because of plate tectonics, because of the motion of the crust of the Earth across the Earth, laterally, like ships in the night, the upwelling punches through the crust at different positions and creates the different islands. And if you actually unroll the film, if you reel back time and look at where the islands were, you know, millions of years ago, you find that it's almost like you had a cigarette under a sheet of paper, and you burned a little hole in the paper.
Mm.
Then you move the cigarette, or you move the paper, and you burn another mark, and then another.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this linear chain of upwellings that burst through the surface.
At 19.5.
At 19.5, because the latitude is fixed relative to the pole.
Gotcha. What about our sun, Richard? Does it also have anomalies at 19.5?
As I said in this paper, this critical paper I found a few years ago by Parker, who was the first to notice this. He was a big solar expert in the 1950s. He noted that the peak of the sunspot cycle occurred with sunspots, which are not all over the sun equally. They basically start at about 30, 40 degrees north latitude, and as the cycle progresses, they winch their way down, a term I use very specifically, toward the equator from both sides, the north pole of the sun, the south pole of the sun. And at the peak of the sunspot cycle, which is every 11 years, they peak at about 19.5 degrees north and south latitude on the sun.
So aren't we, when we discuss this hyperdimensional physics, are we discussing a universal truth, a truth attributed to every body in motion of the sun, the earth, Mars, all the planets?
All the individual spinning planets in this solar system, the solar system itself, all the other stars and potential solar systems that we're finding. I mean, I could you know, bore you with years of data.
You don't have to. I said, is it a universal?
Yes, it appears to be universal.
All right.
What I've been trying to do for the last, 10 years or so is to quietly accumulate more and more mainstream scientific evidence, observational evidence, which basically confirms the theory, the model.
Okay, this is observable. Everybody in the audience who cares to try and prove it to themselves can about this 19.5 point on every
pattern.
Planet. But it's something we can actually see, we can verify for ourselves.
Yep.
It seems very much this dimensional, at least the effects of it.
And well, the effects are, of course, in this dimension because this is where we live. But the cause is not in this dimension, and that's where we go back to the 19th century mathematicians like Cayley and physicists like, Faraday and
okay, well, David, good.
Maxwell is the other guy.
Maxwell, yes, all right, fine. David, you were a student of Richard's. You read his book. You obviously are on fire about...
A distant student.
The meaning of all of this.
We never talked until a couple of years ago.
That's correct, yeah.
But, I mean, in the middle of all this, this is big stuff. Where do you fit? Kind of give me an idea.
Well, what I basically saw was that there was room for the hyperdimensional model to expand. And Richard works on a number of different areas of inquiry, all of which are very important, very fruitful. And I've pretty much chosen to focalize on just the physics.
Mm-hmm.
And where we stand tonight is truly a magnificent place because Richard essentially gave me an assignment, and I completed the assignment, and it's an astonishing body of data that we've come up with, which is showing that the entire solar system, not just at any one point like 19.5, but the planets themselves, and in many cases their moons, are showing dramatic signs of energetic increase, which include increasing atmospheric pressure, increasing brightness from the aurora borealis, increasing magnetic field strength, increasing cataclysmic activity in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I can stand here tonight and basically say to you, name a planet, and I'll tell you what's changing about it. It doesn't even matter which one you pick because we've got data for every single one.
Mars.
Mars. From the mid-1970s to 1997, on the Hubble Telescope website, the director of NASA at the time, Dr. Don Savage, said that between the late 1970s and 1997, Mars had developed clouds, had lost most of its dust, and had picked up a surprise abundance of ozone. Now, one of the things we're talking about in this model has to do with the emergence of this charged energy, like ozone, or plasma, as it's called, this luminous sea of electrons and protons. This is a sign in this new model of a higher degree of energy that's bleeding through to the third dimension. The Mars Surveyor probe was orbiting Mars in 1997 and encountered in one area a 200% increase in the atmospheric pressure from what was expected there.
At a couple hundred miles altitude.
And there's nothing to account for these changes in this dimension. In other words, we can't look at the sun and see more output, or is there anything... I'm looking for physical things that we can, say, account for this change, for example, in Mars. I've even heard there's global warming going on
That's correct.
On Mars. That is
correct. Yeah, I mean, the irony is that all of this data is being released with conventional-sounding explanations.
All right. What would be a conventional-sounding explanation for global warming on Mars? I'd be very interested in that.
It has to do with the ice caps, the regions that are at the poles being tilted more towards the sun. And they claim that because that's going on, that it warms up the planet and melts the ice caps.
And they are melting, aren't they? They are melting.
Oh,
right?
Dramatically so, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the problem is that the timescales don't fit. There is something on Mars, on Earth, and many other planets called obliquity shifts. The tilt of a planet's spin to its orbit around the sun is called its obliquity.
Yes.
For the Earth, it's 23.5 degrees. For Mars, it's 25 degrees. For Jupiter, it's around 3 degrees. For Saturn, it's about 27. You know, you all see models of the solar system where you have these little canted planets rakishly tilted
sure.
the orbit around the sun.
Absolutely.
Planets' obliquities change over time. In mainstream models, this is probably due to gravitational and tidal effects between planets, even over millions of miles. That's a small point of contention, but let's assume that's true. What it means is that you can construct models in the computer which will predict, you know, from here forward or from here back, you know, a million years ago, 5 million years ago, 20 million years ago, what the tilt of the planet would be and the effect of that on the total solar insulation of the planet, how much energy is absorbed and reflected and what it would do to the planetary climate.
All right, Richard, hold tight for a second. David?
Yes.
Venus.
Venus. Between 1978 to 1983, the amount of sulfur gases in Venus's atmosphere, according to Bullock and Grinspoon in Scientific American magazine, decreased dramatically. I'll say that again. The amount of sulfur gas, which obviously smells like rotten eggs, decreased dramatically between 1978 to 83.
Mm-hmm.
A parallel study was done between the Russian probes known as the Venera that visited Venus in 1975 and then with our ground-based Keck telescopes in 1999, there was a difference noticed between the amount of brightness. There's this green light that shows up in Venus's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
In 1975, they didn't see it at all. And in 1999, it was 2,500% brighter. So this is an enormous change.
2,500%.
An increase in,
500% brighter.
Increase in energy.
Actual physical green light.
It's the green line of oxygen. It's the same line that's in the air glow
mm-hmm.
over the Earth. Now, here's the weird part. The Earth's oxygen atmosphere is like 20%, right?
Right.
Yes.
There's supposed to be no oxygen on Venus at all. So where in the space of a few years, did more oxygen come from in the upper Venus atmosphere than is present in the upper terrestrial atmosphere?
And where did all the sulfur go?
These are Genesis-like changes.
Huge.
We're talking
huge.
About the whole world's atmosphere all at once having a dramatic decline in sulfur in 5 years.
Got it.
And they initially pegged this to a mysterious massive volcanic eruption
right.
that must have taken place on Venus. Except, of course, Art, there's no data. There were no observations of any volcanoes by any spacecraft or terrestrial instruments of Venus ever in the history of observing Venus. They simply waved their magic wand, this is the NASA guys, and said, oh, it had to be a volcano, because
mm-hmm.
what else could it be?
Right.
Right. Right.
The problem in science is the what else could it be. This is what Jean Mayhoff was fighting against, because the what else is what leads us to new territory, new discoveries, and new progress.
David?
Yes.
Jupiter.
Oh, man. Jupiter is just incredible. There is this donut-shaped cloud of energy that goes around in the orbit of the moon Io, which is the closest moon to Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
This cloud didn't even show up at all as of 1974. As of 1979, there's this donut luminous cloud showing up around Jupiter. And then between 1979 to 1995, the cloud becomes 200% brighter and denser. At the same time, the moon Io becomes 1,000% higher in its ionosphere, which is where the charged energy goes. It was originally measured in 1973 at between 30 and 60 miles. In 1996, it was at 555 miles. That was from Dr. Lewis Frank from NASA. The surface of Io is actually 3 times hotter than the surface of Mercury. Okay, now Mercury is right next to the Sun. But here's Io hanging out around Jupiter, 3 times hotter than the surface of Mercury, and it increased in its temperature by over 200% between 1979 and 1998.
Boy. And that's not counting the volcanoes.
Boy.
Right.
Boy, oh boy. Are you beginning to see a commonality here, folks?
And I'm telling you, just pick a planet. It doesn't even matter.
Saturn.
Saturn. There is an aurora that was first seen, this glowing luminous energy, seen for the first time in 95 at the polar regions. Some weird stuff is going on there. I found one study from Dr. Ed Sittler et al. That shows that between 1981 and 1993, a donut of energy very similar to the one we see around Jupiter, similar one around Saturn, had become 1,000% more dense and bright.
Wow.
These are global changes of geological proportion occurring in just years, Art.
Yeah.
Not thousands of years or millions of years.
Just years.
But stunningly short periods of time.
12 years in this case.
I've got it. That is very fast indeed. All right, David, Earth.
All kinds of good stuff. In 1998, the Van Allen belts had a new belt of energy that showed up for the first time. And this was something that had never been seen before. It was basically where you have I'll read you the quote. It says, "Activity in Earth's two known Van Allen radiation belts grew so intense in May 1998 that a new belt was created which generated excitement and awe in the scientific community." And as we go on, we had Richard and you talking back in February 96, and I was a listener at that time, about this tethered satellite.
That's right.
Remember that one?
Clearly.
It melts, and, you know, it's this satellite. Just for the reader's sake, I'll say that it's this satellite that's attached to this very thin wire.
Listeners.
Stretches out for a long way, and it just burned up. And NASA had built this thing supposedly foolproof, and I found one article on CNN that was linked from these other articles that said that the tether was foolproof. And, of course, when you try to link on that one, it's no longer there, and Google doesn't have it either. So,
well, it didn't just burn up. And, Mark, this is a vivid recollection down memory lane, because after they deployed it, remember, it was built by the Italians. It had this highly instrumented satellite at the end of this very long wire. They kind of unreeled it from a fishing reel kind of thing in the cargo bay. And mile after mile after mile, it got out to its farthest deployment, and they were coming over the terminator between the sunset and nighttime side of the Earth. And it was exactly at the terminator, over the evening terminator, that something happened, and they got a massive surge of current. Thousands of times what they had modeled, expected from their computer calculations based
Indeed.
On other physics.
That's true.
And the tether burned through. They had a press conference shortly thereafter, and the guys inside, the astronauts, looked like Bambi in the headlights. They looked terrified, because you can imagine a several mile long piece of wire snapping back and forth that would have sliced the shuttle in two.
Yeah, they damn near lost it, actually.
They almost lost it. They also, and this was not reported, they had massive power surges on other instruments, onboard computers. They lost 2 out of the 3 backup computers. They almost did not make it home. But no one to this day at NASA will acknowledge where all the excess energy came from. And remember that night that we had on Bruce De Palma from Australia?
Yes.
Or from New Zealand?
Yes, yes.
And we talked about the De Palma experiments in the end machine?
Right.
If you rotate a conductor at high speed, even in the presence of no magnetic field, it develops a charge at the rim, and you can pull electron current off the rim if you put a connector between the pole and the rim.
So yeah, it kind of works like a lawn sprinkler.
Yeah, this goes back to Faraday in 1835, back to the 19th century physics again, which is called a homopolar generator and does not conform to any known physics.
Well, they obviously got far more than they expected.
It
far
was a
more
free energy,
energy
device.
Well,
it was an orbital free energy device, and the guys who built it didn't know what was going to happen, and so they almost fried 7 astronauts.
Yes, I know.
Now, here's the bottom line on that.
How does the extra energy that they experienced fit into your model?
Because it's like a giant end machine. It's like what's going on with the rings of Saturn, which we're going to get back to in a second. If you have a rotating object in orbit around the Earth, or you have the Earth itself, you know, you, by the way, have your own little hyperdimensional experiment going on there out in the desert.
Yes.
You have this antenna that you've been talking about loud and long.
I know.
You've got a mile or so of wire in, what, two tiers?
Yeah, that's right.
Lofted a couple hundred feet in the air?
Not a couple hundred feet. 75 feet and 68,
okay,
respectively, but a mile of wire,
okay,
yes.
Okay, you have got a conductor suspended above the planet on a rotating ball. You have a miniature free energy end machine generator. Because it has nothing to do with air electricity.
I know.
It's not cutting through the Earth's magnetic field. It's moving with the field.
Okay. Richard, we've got to hold it right there. Well, you know, I can confirm certain aspects of that. That energy is there in AC and DC components on a clear, windless day. Just to preclude a lot of, you know, well, you're just getting static kind of calls. I've tested and tested again, and I'm telling you right now that energy is there on a clear, windless, sunny, beautiful, still birds chirping kind of day. So there you are. I don't know what it is that I've got. I guess Richard thinks he knows, but I can tell you it's real. From the high desert in the middle of the night, this is Coast to Coast AM. Once again, Richard C. Hoagland and David Wilcox. So the big question is, where is the energy coming from? Is there enough energy to produce these kinds of rapid, dramatic, profound earth changes, as in our climate flipping suddenly? Well, there's a lot of evidence to indicate that, yes, as a matter of fact, there was a story last week that all of the the Dust Bowl in the United States, a very tragic event, it was really horrible, you should do some reading about the Dust Bowl, God, it's incredible, was produced by just a couple of degrees of ocean change temperature. So, I don't know, would there be energy, gentlemen, for a kind of global superstorm, a kind of thing that would have perhaps frozen plants in woolly mammoths' mouths, flash froze stuff down in South America, they're finding now, and even corpses and all kinds of things, but the geologists all kind of can't figure it out, so they put it up on a shelf somewhere and say, we're not going to deal with this.
Do you want the long answer or the short answer?
I'll always vote for the, when it comes to you, Richard, just don't even...
And then you wonder why people ask if we have a feud going on.
Short answer, Richard.
All right. Do you remember the film Forbidden Planet?
Oh, so well.
That incredible film, which
of
I
course.
Hope they don't remake. That would be such a tragedy. Certain things should be left exactly the way they are. Remember the scene in the Krell lab with Walter Pidgeon?
Yes.
Who's the actor that went into different things, but he played the Starship Commander?
Oh, I don't remember.
Okay. Anyway, there's a scene where the doctor, you know, the guy's name was Morbius, the Walter Pidgeon guy.
Yeah.
And he's been there for 20 years trying to figure out this incredible super science left by this race that mysteriously vanished before the expedition got there.
Right.
And they've now figured out that the reason they vanished is because they created this incredible technology that could materialize out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Just consciousness.
Thought.
Physical objects and energy and could cut through even incredible numbers of feet of so-called Krell supermetal.
Yep.
And there is this picture, this stunning scene that had been done by this set designer who was a genius, whose name I forget, of all these electrical meters. And you know what the old-fashioned ammeters
times
used to
10,
look like?
Times 10 times 10
yeah,
times
exactly.
10.
Yeah, exactly.
To infinity, virtually. In other words,
as the power of infinity. That is the amount of energy, Art, in hyperdimensional space, in hyperspace, available to do all of the awful things you just described. There is no limit to it.
All right. But and I guess here's where David comes back in. Are you saying, David, that we're now seeing on all planetary bodies that we're able to observe sufficiently an increase energy level output? I think I've got that right. You're certainly saying yes. The answer is yes. Where do you think this is headed?
Well, I want to give fair airtime to my hypothesis as well as Richard's, because I think both of us are on the right track.
All right, but you differ, apparently. Let's hear how.
Well, most of the Russians who have been looking at this stuff have simply concluded that there are separated zones of energy in the galaxy, and this is an energy that Western science is not aware of. Richard would call it hyperdimensional energy. I might call it torsion fields, quantum medium, whatever. It's the same basic stuff. The idea being that one really major competing hypothesis here is that we're moving into an area of the galaxy where this energy is higher. There's one guy by the name of Dr. Sergei Smelyakov, and what he's done is to show that 2012 represents sort of like an implosion period. And if you can just imagine briefly that you have a bottle of salad dressing and the oil and the water have separated and there's a nice straight line between the two. When we look at hyperdimensional energy, there's a variety of things going all the way back to Tesla and earlier showing that in many cases this energy behaves similar to a fluid. One of the things that happens when you vibrate a fluid is that geometry appears inside the fluid. It's a natural waveform. Happens to be three-dimensional. Scientists don't like that because it's a lot harder to model a three-dimensional wave than a two-dimensional wave. But this gets back to some of the Maxwell stuff where there were 200 quaternions, as he called them, which are basically mathematical things that let you make coordinates in four dimensions rather than three. It's probably the easiest way to say it. And so he mapped out that even in electromagnetic energy, there's these hidden, what Richard calls scalar potentials, that are sort of pushing on that electromagnetic wave. The tetrahedron's hiding in there. So then what we're talking about basically is that the very energy that underlies matter and consciousness and the behavior of light, the speed of light, all this stuff, can vary from one place to another. It appears that there are zones in which this energy can vary within a single galaxy. And it also appears that 2012 represents a waterline between one density and another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot more technical than I'd really want to try to go into. But basically, if you have, if you throw a little stone into a pond, you get ripples. And you can see these ripples. Well, there's ripples coming off of this waterline. And they're all partitioned based on what many people already know about, the golden mean ratio. And every time we punch through one of these walls, we get huge earthquakes, we get the fall of major civilizations, we get the arising of new spiritual teachings, and we get the arising of new forms of measuring time.
And this is a cycle that repeats?
It implodes into 2012, meaning that the closer we get to 2012, the more frequently we're going to hit these walls.
So it'll come in waves.
Right.
See, the difference between David's model and mine is probably the razor blade on which this whole idea is balanced.
I guess it's very important, isn't it, Richard? You're saying that the energy is within the planets.
No. What I'm saying is the trigger mechanism to access it is different than David's model. David is using some Russian work which basically says we move from one region of the galaxy to another.
And we're going to run into this energy.
All right. I'm saying that even if we didn't have a galaxy, if the Earth and the Sun existed all by its lonesome, these changes would still be going on.
As a result of?
Of modulation by the movements of the planets around the Sun, particularly some big eyes way out there in the dark that have not yet been rediscovered by modern 21st century science. They act like potentiometers, ratcheting up and ratcheting down this energy, you know, gated in from higher dimensional space.
Would one of those be the infamous Planet X?
Yes, but it's not on a collision course. It's on a circular orbit, more or less. It's permanently out there. There may be another one. If you do the numbers, it looks like we probably need two. They're in very, very long orbits. This new little tiny asteroid they discovered, Sedna, the other day,
yes,
and announced, don't you find it rather curious that, and again, we know we have a space agency that's dealing in rituals and symbolism and you know, hidden messages, but don't you find it interesting that this thing has an orbital period of 11,500 years, which
uh-huh.
happens to be the Bovall age when Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall think that the civilization, last peaked on Earth and built the pyramids and had high technology and then was wiped out by some massive terrestrial cataclysm?
Quite intriguing.
And wait for the good stuff. Do you know where the name Sedna comes from? It's the Inuit goddess of victims. The press said it was goddess of the sea, but when you actually read the legends, she's the goddess of victims.
Huh.
It's kind of like the in crowd are projecting that because of these planetary movements in this time frame on a cyclic recurring pattern, there will be more victims, Art.
Mm.
So we have a separation. We have the in crowd that may know a little more than they're letting on in these papers. We then have the science community publishing all these observations. And then we have David and myself putting the data together and saying, wait a minute, it's a different picture than the mainstream is conveying to you and much more serious, and we got to pay very close attention.
This is sort of a side question, but Isaac in Portland, Maine asks this. He says, fascinating interview. And I can't help but think that all this increased energy and global change throughout the solar system is having a social impact on humans. Now,
oh, he is right on.
Absolutely.
He is right on. David, you want to take this and then I'll give it a whack?
Yeah.
Sure, I'd love to do that one. One of the ways that we can most benefit from this knowledge that we're sharing tonight is in understanding how we can actually harness the energy for ourselves, how we can use it, because it just so happens that there is a way in which we could help to solve the problems of the biosphere, the problems that are going to be shown in this $125 million blockbuster the day after tomorrow. We're not helpless. And if there's one thing that Richard and I can do, it's to put aside any weird little differences we have in a hypothesis and get down to the truth. So when we're talking about biology, we're talking about something that links together whatever your different hypotheses are to some sort of common ground. Now, it appears that when the Martians put together the Sedona Plateau, they told us about the physics. But they also might have been telling us about the physics because they knew that on a predictable cyclical pattern, that the kind of changes that we're seeing right now would be happening. They may have also given us the solution in that the actual message is encoded in giant pyramids.
Well, if they had the solution, then why are they gone?
I think they basically started doing it too late. I think they discovered the technology too late. They started to build the pyramids because they knew what they would do, but they hadn't started it soon enough, and they ran out of time.
I have a little different take on it, Art.
All right.
I think that, and again, we're leaping now to the end of the story, and you know I hate doing that. I like to document so people can
right,
get where we're going.
Just play along.
Okay. Well, I can do that. I think that the Mars experience is a cautionary tale for what human beings have done over and over and over again, which is to basically kill themselves off. I think we're looking at the end product of a cataclysmic war, which wound up with literal destruction of some members of the ancient solar system. And when that happened, this physics, which used to work like a well-oiled machine, like a perfectly tuned Accutron watch, became broken. Now, here's where you have to understand a little bit of how the physics works. It isn't the static geometry. In other words, we're not looking at tetrahedrons and planets with, you know, vertices poking out through the crust. We're looking at resonance patterns in the ether mediating the energy between dimensions. So it's kind of like sound waves or any other kind of waveform. You get what are called standing wave patterns. And those patterns can look solid, but in fact, they're all energy. They're just basically patterns of energy in empty space.
Well, that sounds an awful lot like David was describing the Russian theory that we're going to be bumping into.
I'm talking about the space of the solar system. Again,
yes.
Forget the galaxy and just think about the solar system, the 9 plus maybe 2 more planets orbiting around the sun with little satellites orbiting around them. As they wheel around each other, these energy patterns caused by the spinning of each of the massive planets cause David's ripples in the pond. That's an excellent analogy, all right? But imagine if you had moving ripples on a stationary pond where you have overlapping rings. You would have interference patterns. You'd have constructive and destructive interference. If everything was perfectly positioned and timed and spinning at the right synchronized rate, it would all be like one extraordinary orchestra of music, something like the most amazing cantata or symphony ever written, where there was not one discordant note. But what happens if you eliminate a major section of the orchestra, blow it up, all right? You wind up with discordance. You wind up with waves that interfere as opposed to constructively reinforce. And the solar system, in my model, that we're living in is a broken solar system following the catastrophe, the war that resulted in the disappearance of the guys on Mars, who eventually were a tiny fragment of us that appeared here. If that's true, if we're living in the decayed ruins of the former glory of a system that worked perfectly, that was perfectly in tune, then the physics is broken. And these periodic catastrophes are, these upwellings and massive energy increases and all the other things that we're seeing,
yes,
are not part of the normal functioning of the system. They're because it's broken. And we must use our knowledge of this physics while we have time to figure out how to fix it on the one place where we are still living, which is namely planet Earth.
We actually have a way to do that that does not violate national security, does not reveal any unforeseen technological advances, but which could actually reduce or eliminate a lot of the problems that we're having.
How would you fix it?
You remember the work of Dr. John DeSalvo, talking about the Giza pyramids, and that there were scientists in Russia who have built these 144-foot-tall pyramids out of fiberglass and PVC plastic. And basically, some of the things that have happened include things that would really be able to help the environment in such a dramatic way that it seems pretty clear that any planet, when it gets to a certain level of sophistication, is naturally going to take use of this.
What are you suggesting could be done with a pyramid? What in the experiments that the Russians did would suggest that the pyramids have the power to do anything at all?
Okay, let's say, for example, that we want to save the oil fields. We want to get more oil out of the ground while we're making a transition to free energy.
Okay.
There was a academy in Moscow known as the Gubkin Moscow Academy of Oil and Gas. They built some pyramids over the oil wells. And they discovered that the viscosity, the thickness of the oil under the pyramids, decreased by 30%, which also caused an increase in production by 30% compared to all the surrounding wells.
Easier to bring up.
Yeah. And
now, you know that domestically we have huge oil wells in the Midwest, in Texas, in the Panhandle, in Oklahoma, that have basically stopped producing at an economic level,
yes,
because they're basically sludge.
You're saying we need big pyramids over them.
If this were tried here in the United States and had the same results as happened in the old Soviet Union, we could go domestically for a lot of what we're importing now, and we could reduce our dependence on the Mideast and all the concomitant problems that is currently engendering.
Hold it right there, gentlemen. Richard C. Hoagland and David Wilcock are my guests. We're discussing an energy, a universal energy source that we're right in the middle of. It's all around us. We're also, of course, discussing the death, the murder of Eugene Maloff, somebody who was leading the charge toward that energy. Bad news for this night. I'm Art Bell.
Riders on the storm, riders on the storm.
Interesting. Bob in Lincoln, Nebraska says that Richard has relied too much on science. Bob from Lincoln says, we are the ones that are broken. We are the ones that are broken, not the universe. We are the energy of everything, all that is. Now, that's a slightly, perhaps, egotistical point of view, but who knows?
Well, let me address Bob, okay? Because we didn't say the universe is broken. I said this solar system. We are one solar system, in a, you know, circling a star.
It's all that will matter to us anyway.
Of 400 billion stars in the Milky Way alone.
Mm-hmm.
But we're one place where we know we're alive and conscious, and we now have astonishing evidence that something came before. That's why I was so gratified that Gene really, really, before he died, got that unmistakably, that this is science, we've got the data, and he was feeling we were on the verge of a breakthrough in our area, like he said he thought he was on the verge of a breakthrough in his area, where he's fought so many years and so hard.
Well, if you go to where these pyramids are here on Earth, Richard, you encounter a man known as Zahi Hawass.
Ah, yes.
And I stood in the desert next to one of, next to the Great Pyramid, actually. And Dr. Zahi said, if you think these are machines, then you are crazy as all of the other conspiratorial people on the globe and the Earth right now. They're crazy. This is not a machine. I couldn't even imitate his voice. It was built by Egyptians. It's not even this and that, but it's not
Art,
a machine. It's Art, a joke.
The pyramids were machines. They were an astonishing legacy of a super science, a hyperdimensional science that Gene and I were discussing, that came and went and probably was left as kind of the terrestrial marker for the kind of science we have to reinvent if we're going to save ourselves as the years progress.
Do you recall, as the year 2000 came about, you two, as we were coming up to the big
Y2K.
Change? Y2K. Zahi said that there was going to be a capstone put back on the Great Pyramid.
I remember that.
That was a big deal. I talked to Zahi about that,
well,
and his eyes got bright, and he was so excited about it.
Do you know why it was a big deal?
Well, I'm thinking you'll tell me.
Esoteric symbolism.
Exactly. If you go to enterprisemission.com, and David will give a plug for his website, but if you go to Enterprise tonight, you will find a multi-chaptered saga, which we titled The End of Days. I think we've got five parts of it up there now, and we're working on a sixth. We started doing this at the 2000 crossing point because we noticed, among other things, that Zahi was very, very eager to have this high-level celebration.
He was, yes.
In the desert around the pyramids.
Yes.
On 2000. That was the same moment, by the way, when we crossed from 1999 to 2000, and you and I shared that night, remember, Art?
Of course.
Where we found that the ball on the Florida Times Square had turned into this stunning, multifaceted, spinning tetrahedral symbol.
Yep.
Which has all these little tetrahedrons spinning around. I mean, it was like the in crowd was telling us right on global television, this is how the world and the background of reality really works. So there, take it. You know, there's nothing you can do with it because we
all right, own it. I have more trouble with symbology, and I don't always
let me finish.
You know, see the stuff. I see the
we
rocks.
We don't want rumors of a feud to start. Let me finish.
Right, sure.
When I started looking at the celestial mechanics, because remember, in our model of the physics, it's all time to celestial positions within and around the solar system.
Right.
By the way, with one homage to David, the galaxy is important, but only in terms of the center of mass, the center of the galaxy, and how the solar system is slowly moving into an alignment on the winter solstice in the northern hemisphere on December 21, 2012, with the center of the Milky Way, the biggest spinning mass in our neighborhood, so to speak, only 26,000 light years away.
Mm-hmm.
It's these spinning masses that trigger the shifts and the ducting of energy. And if the system is not capable of handling it, if the energy is dissonant, if the music is off key, think of running fingernails over a blackboard.
Try and explain to me how pyramids properly placed, and I presume operating with capstones or whatever, would affect this.
Well, that's not what,
otherwise
that's not
discordant.
What Zahi was trying to do.
Well,
Zahi was trying to do was.
Now, what I'm asking
I finish where we were going?
Yes.
Because as we were looking at this run-up to 2012 and how any of this could make sense to any rational person, I tripped over a remarkable piece of astronomical information. A key factor in the whole Egyptian mythology, cosmology, is the star Sirius, right?
Mm-hmm.
She stands for Isis,
yes,
the goddess of fertility and the mother of mankind and all that.
Yes.
Statue of Liberty.
Yeah. If you imagine that we have lines going from the North Pole to the South Pole, going across the equator,
mm-hmm,
like the line at Greenwich where the day begins, that's the modern equivalent of the ancient line that went from the pole down through the Great Pyramid and down to the South Pole. That used to be the meridian of the Earth.
Right.
So what I did was, in the computer, I set up a calculation, and I looked out as if I was standing in the King's Chamber, and the pyramid was transparent. I was looking toward the south at midnight on that magic night when Zahi wanted to do his big ceremony. And by the way, invite about half of the bigwigs from all over the planet, including George Bush Sr. and the Prince of Wales and God knows who else, to be with him in that desert ceremony. You knew that was part of the plan, right?
I knew it was magnificent.
The biggest party ever thrown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was the wrong date. The millennium, as we know, was 2000 to 2001, not 1999 to 2000. And no wiggling the figures can make a fact wrong or right. The numbers are the numbers. So I kept asking myself, why do they want to have this huge planetary party on the wrong night, a year ahead of when it should be taken care of? It turned out very simply that that was the night, for the only time, get this, David, in galactic history, when Sirius crossed the meridian, the ancient Giza meridian, precisely at midnight.
Uh-huh.
From then on, it is to the east of the meridian,
okay. And
it was to the west before. So that was like a dividing line.
I know. This has
now,
great meaning for you, Richard.
Wait. We're not getting to the good stuff yet. If you look at that line where it is in the sky, you extend that line like a celestial meridian out into space, so it goes through, you know, where Sirius is in the sky. If you track 12 degrees to the east, 1 degree per year, which is how Sirius will move in relation to the Earth and relation to the galactic center, when that alignment occurs at midnight in 2012, that will be the winter solstice, and D-Day will have arrived. In other words, that ceremony marked the beginning of a 12-year clock,
right,
the final countdown to something happening in 2012 by these guys, led by Zahi, who know something that they are not wanting the rest of us to figure out.
All right, I'm going to try to ask again. What I want to know, Richard, is, you both have indicated that these pyramids have the potential to save the planet from what otherwise is going to occur, to use this energy.
Okay, what's the most massive catastrophe you can imagine on Earth? Bigger than
an unaltered, continued course that we're on right now.
Okay, I'm not talking human generated. I'm not talking social devolution or people fighting over resources or.
Well, I'm not sure it's not all mixed up together.
I'm talking big natural catastrophe. What's the biggest natural catastrophe you can imagine for this planet?
I can imagine a lot of them, Richard.
The biggest one. Come on, the biggest one.
I'll say it's pole shift.
Exactly.
Okay, fine.
If the pole flips over, we are 78% area water. If you get what's called the slosh effect, and oceans slosh over the continents at 1,000 miles per hour, scouring everything down to bedrock, the atmosphere whistles across the plains at 1,000 miles an hour, scouring everything down to bedrock, there's almost nothing left if the planet physically flips over in space. I'm not talking a magnetic shift.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking a physical flip from one obliquity orientation dramatically in a heartbeat to another obliquity orientation.
Okay, and again, my question is, how do we prevent this catastrophic event from occurring? What is it that pyramids do, and how do they do it? What do we know about that?
Well, here's where we get interesting. What we believe the pyramids were trying to do, built by the prior civilization, and when I say we, I mean me and Hancock and Bivol. I don't know what David and I ever talked about this. I don't know whether David is even in the same...
Yeah, we're on the same page.
On the same page. Okay, I might have imagined, given we're coming at this from two different directions, but we're parallel here. What the pyramids were trying to do, Art, was stave off, through resonance vibrations connecting to hyperspace, the catastrophic interference pattern that results in the Earth literally flipping over, seeking what's called a new degree of freedom. When you have... Think of the model of the atom, all right, where you have electrons orbiting around protons and hydrogen.
Yes.
And every once in a while, you'll have a little electron go flip. It does that because it cannot handle the energy coming into it in its current state. It must change its orientation to an anti-parallel spin so that it equalizes out the waves, so that the music is harmonious as opposed to discordant. It really is kind of like celestial music. What seems to happen is in the broken condition of the solar system, the broken condition of the Earth, when the energy mounting in the background, which is what all this planetary data that we have now, we're going to put on the Enterprise website in a three-part series beginning in the next couple of days. We got part one up there tonight. You can go to enterprisemission.com and read it. It's right at the top of the page. We'll have the two parts showing all the data, all the sources, all the institutions, all the evidence that something big is building all over the solar system. When that building crescendo hits, the Earth can't take it. It must do something physically to reorient itself to the frequencies and the vibration of the energy, because it's a massive overload. It's like a huge short circuit. So what it does is it reorients its physical spin axis. It also changes the rate of the day length. And it may even change the orbit a little bit. But the primary effect is it reorients the spin axis where most of the energy is stored. And then it comes to equilibrium again for the next 12,000 plus years. We do not want that to happen. That is bad for beagles and begonias, as Carl Sagan used to say. It wipes out almost everybody when this hits the fan. So what do the ancients try to do? They tried to build, in essence, a modulator, an energized modulator, which is the Great Pyramid, connected, made of limestone, 6 million tons of limestone, connected to God knows how many gigatons of limestone in a band of 70 million year limestone stretching from Giza all the way to Indonesia in the crust of the Earth, ancient coral reefs.
All right.
This material, the limestone, is an operative, active, hyper-dimensional medium.
Okay, right, I've got it.
It's
okay.
The key medium.
Richard, then the people who did it on Mars and the people who did it on Earth, both were unsuccessful.
That's right.
So...
Well, maybe and maybe not. What if most of these pyramids were built after something had already happened? And by building them, they actually stabilized things and got it back to working order a lot faster than otherwise would have happened.
That's a viable idea.
Possibility,
very
I suppose.
Very viable idea.
Yeah.
Now,
but see, they learned about it too late, whereas we know about it now.
Or they were prevented by all the nonsense and chicanery that's going on now, and where you keep killing people off to try to introduce the way physics really works. Remember, 100 years ago, if we... we're having this conversation tonight, Art, we wouldn't be having the same conversation. We would be surrounded by this technology, this physics, this knowledge, and it would be ample time to do major, huge, important things to even out the music so the planet does not flip.
Yeah, let me kick in one thing here. Bush just asked for $24 billion for us to continue fighting this war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Our rough guesstimate calculations are that for $150 million, which is only a percentage of 1 billion, that we could build a worldwide network of these pyramids that would increase the production of these oil wells, they would purify water for people who don't have sanitation right now, They would do things such as reducing the overall amount of earthquake activity.
David, can you prove it on scale?
Sure.
The Russians already demonstrated it.
The Russians have done it. I mean, you got
to
understand.
Go to David's website. I'm sure there's a link there. You can read the papers yourself in the mainstream Soviet literature. They did it. They've been doing a lot of things that the West doesn't know about.
I know.
Yeah,
I know that. I know that's true. And you're saying the Russians built pyramids over oil wells.
Over old defunct oil wells.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And increased and their production by 20 to 30%.
30%?
Through thinning the viscosity, right?
Yeah.
So that the production increased and they got that much more out.
Yeah, one of the side effects is it changes molecular viscosities. There's umpteen experiments in labs all over the world. I mean, if we were to go and do the same thing for physics and chemistry that we're trying to do for planetary science in this three-part paper, we'd have the work for the next decade cut out for us. It's just art that no one has assembled this data into a coherent, different paradigm picture of really what's going on.
You guys remember
stuck with some very old ideas, and my question, and this is going to sound almost treasonous, is are we stuck with this through ignorance or because somebody wants a lot of people to die?
Well, it's worth thinking about. I wanted to point out one thing.
I suppose it is.
Do you remember years ago a book came out called Alternative 3?
Yes.
And initially I dismissed it as pure bunk.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you did too. The closer we get to this date, and the more I learn, and the more I see going on, and the more the physics comes together, and the predictive data, you know, the dots all match up, I'm wondering now if that was not kind of the prescription for what a few in the know are planning to do while the rest of us, you know, basically, you know, kiss our you-know-what goodbye.
Well, I had somebody from Black Ops tell me that the so-called astronaut named Grodin was actually an anagram for Gordon. And we're not talking the guy whose first name is Gordon. We're talking an astronaut whose last name was Gordon. And a lot of that stuff actually was true. What the Alternative 3 said way back in the 70s was that the whole solar system was going to be heating up.
Yep.
And that Mars would become a more viable place to live as a result.
All right. Gentlemen, hold on. This is Alternative 3 for me. I've got to break. We've got the news coming up. Certainly talking of cosmic things this morning, aren't we? What do you feel about it? As you listen to all these different people of all these different... Oh, what's the right word? All these different persuasions, remote viewers, the Hopi, intuitives, people like Richard C. Hoagland and David. We'll be right back. Geologically, I have no problem whatsoever believing that the magnitude of the changes that we're discussing right now have occurred in the past. We have evidence of that. We just sort of put it up on the shelf and ignore it, but you really can't. It did happen. I think most of us in the pit of our stomach know that it happened and that it can happen again. Once again, my guests, Richard C. Hoagland, David Wilcock, gentlemen, an email, which I just happened to grab very quickly. The program tonight seems to indicate that the size of the pyramid has the ability to focus the energy from the cosmos. If the fluid parameters of oil have changed, as demonstrated by what you said in Russia, imagine what would happen if the surface tension of biochemical reaction were changed. All reactions in our body require this surface tension or contact with molecules to cause biochemical reactions. Jerry from Vista, California. So, comments?
David?
Well, the pyramid power that we're talking about goes well beyond simply non-technical things. And when you start getting into biology science, it gets even more bizarre and interesting. Let me give you a couple examples, which are really fascinating.
Sure.
The first one was done by the Ivanovsky R&D Institute of Virology within the Russian Academy of Medical Science. Now, this is mainstream stuff.
Okay.
You got to remember, the Soviet Union, prior to 1991, was toe-to-toe with the U.S.
Sure.
But then when they collapsed, You have these scientists who are literally living on $30 a month,
right,
who have the time and the incentive to do this pyramid research. So anyway, Klemenko and Nosek from this Ivanovsky R&D Institute took a drug called venoglobulin, which is a naturally occurring compound in a human being's blood that fights viruses. When they diluted this drug down to 50 micrograms per milliliter and stored it in the pyramid for a short time, mm-hmm. it became 300% more effective at killing viruses. Another one which I find really fascinating came from the R&D Institute of Pediatrics, Obstetrics, and Gynecology, headed by Professor A.G. Antonov. They took a solution of 40% glucose and distilled water and put it in the pyramid, and all they gave was 1 milliliter of this glucose to 20 different premature babies with compromised immune systems. The babies that were given this formula had their health increased to rapidly practical and normal levels, whereas the control group had no real change.
God, these are incredible things you're saying. So if these things are true, then why wouldn't science in the West say, oh my God, and let's see if we can duplicate that experiment?
Well, given that we've had 15 years of non-progress in the so-called cold fusion area,
yes,
where we had a stunning experiment, you know, with eminently world-class reputable scientists in Utah, with an astonishing support from the Congress, because I know Robert Rowe enacted legislation to try to move to help them almost immediately. How do I know this? Because I had a meeting with him on the Mars question. He was the head of the House Science Committee. I had a meeting on Cydonia, and one of the things we discussed back then, in 1989, was, you know, cold fusion and how he was moving to get the committee to help. Do you know what happened to Robert Rowe? He was first drummed out of his House chairmanship. He then was drummed out of the House itself, and he, having sideswiped and almost killed a woman and her little girl in a van one dark night, because having sideswiped and almost killed a woman and her little girl in a van one dark night because he was basically an alcoholic. He fell from the supreme science position in the U.S. Congress to a drunk because something intervened in his career and what he wanted to do to help Bonds and Fleischmann and to help me with Cydonia redounded to his profound detriment. You want to know why this stuff is not mainstream? There is a control mechanism. There is censorship. It is, as Gene Mayoff said in his last editorial, it is the evil, the invisible evil of science and politics in 21st century.
Why would the West and modern science in the West want to suppress something that could save all of humanity?
How is science funded?
By government.
And where does government get its money?
From us.
It picks our pockets, right?
Yeah.
It decides what's priorities. It decides what's nonsense and pseudoscience.
Yes.
In order for a scientist to maintain a living, to put his kids through school, to pay for his car, keep a house over his head, he has to get grants. If the only trough you get a grant from is from agencies that tell you what is acceptable and not acceptable, you quickly learn to fall in line with what's acceptable. Gene said in
But that's not answering my question.
Gene,
that's the business end of what you consider to be a conspiracy. My question
was, without business, you have no science
yes,
anymore.
Yes, but my question was, Richard, really, if we understood it to be of this magnitude, mm-hmm. why would we be suppressing something that would?
Who is we, Kemosabe?
Well, whatever group you imagine to be doing this would stop.
How about
all
the National Science Foundation? How about Science Magazine?
How about them?
Nature?
How about them?
They have what's called, Gene used to call it sneer review, where you basically can be attacked. In fact, let me get a specific.
But my overall question is not being answered. Why would we want to block a technology?
But we don't, Art.
I don't mean you, Richard, David. I mean us collectively.
The collective body of Americans,
yes.
or the collective body of citizens of Italy or France or Germany or Soviet Union,
yes.
we're not in charge. Somebody else is, and they dictate our reality. They dictate the rules. They dictate the funding. And those who do not go along pay awful prices up to and maybe including the ultimate price.
But if they, in quotes, mm-hmm. whoever in the hell they are,
yes.
understood the magnitude of what's going to occur around 2012.
Who says they intend to be here when it hits the fan? That's the back to the alternative three model.
And you're also dealing with religious beliefs.
Where do you think they plan to be?
Okay, remember when I came to Nevada and I showed you some things and then I sent you a piece of video and I asked you to
yes.
sit on it for a year?
Yes.
The STS-80 video.
I recall extremely well, yes.
And you saw, and then ultimately Whitley wound up putting it on NBC, what looked to be like extraordinary spaceships cavorting around in Earth orbit that are light years beyond the shuttle.
Yes.
And my model is that they aren't aliens, they aren't ETs, they are ours. They're part of a secret black budget program which has been going on ever since 1947 when, according to your friend, you know, a certain Philip Corso,
yes.
we back-engineered a stunning hyperdimensional propulsion and energy technology and have quietly put it to use in the military in a black ops program. And I believe they intend, who these they are, to take a bunch of their cronies and friends, and when the going gets tough, they will get going, probably to Mars. Now, back during the day when Hubble was broken, remember Hubble being broken?
Yes.
It couldn't take a decent picture if its life depended on it?
Yes.
I'm walking through the airport in O'Hare, in Chicago, one afternoon, and I happen to see on the newsstand this extraordinary color cover image of Life magazine. And it's a picture of Mars in full color taken by the broken Hubble telescope, which at that point, because I was kind of close to Hubble, remember the school project I had in Washington where we had the Hubble guys coming in and talking to the kids, so I knew a lot about what was going on. And I said to myself, why in the world, in the middle of their crisis, are they taking pictures of Mars with this damn broken telescope? The title of that Life cover was Our Next Home.
Hmm.
I wonder who that cover was directed to.
I don't know. To imagine with you, Richard, all of this is to imagine that somebody's making a pretty poor bet. If their bet is to hell with Earth, we're going to let it go through its cyclical change without trying to harness whatever powers you're suggesting to me can change it that have mm-hmm. to do with pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to go racing off to Mars where we're going to have a jolly old time while everybody else on Earth dies. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me that would be a plan of anybody. And, I mean, it's not such a good bet, Richard, right now, going to Mars and abandoning a dying Earth.
I'm not quite sure what your problem is, that they wouldn't have the audacity to do that, they wouldn't have the technology, they wouldn't have the money, they wouldn't have the secrecy, they wouldn't have the instinct, they wouldn't have the motivation. Where's the problem in the model, in the theory?
Well, Mars doesn't look like a warm Caribbean island, Richard. It doesn't look...
Yeah, but if it's the only place you can go and not get blown to smithereens because the planet's going to tip over, it's kind of... You know, remember the old joke about where does an 800-pound gorilla sleep?
Anywhere
it wants
to. Yes.
Okay. We have people living tonight at the bottom of the world in frigid, absolutely minus 120-degree below temperatures and howling 60, 80-mile-an-hour gale winds, right?
Yes, we do.
And we used to have them powered by nuclear power before the environmentalists chucked the nukes out of McMurdo. So we're trucking in lots and lots of oil to keep the gas burners going and the mm-hmm. generators going. And in that bubble down there, that geodesic dome, courtesy of Bucky Fuller, we have men and women, and you and I have discussed very strange things going on at the bottom of the world, haven't we not?
We have.
That have lived in a little bubble of technology and light in the middle of such desolation and such privation and cold that you could not survive outside 10 minutes unprotected, right?
Yes.
Mars is far more benign than the Antarctic.
But,
why?
But still not a cakewalk.
But with proper technology and all the money they can pick from your pocket and mine that no one ever is tracking, a few, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, whatever number you think is the few, could keep the human race alive when the rest of it goes to heck in a handbasket.
Why let that happen, Richard?
Because they may not know they can do anything different. Remember what my old intel friend used to say and says to me again and again when he talks to me. He says, the lie is different at every level. If you look at some of the things that are written about these catastrophes by those that are most in the know, they themselves think it is unstoppable. It's like, you know, I used to have a girlfriend, and she was into astrology, and one day she looked at me and she says, "I can't fight the planets. They're bigger than I am." And I'm looking at this problem in that vein, that we have been taught that you can't fight Mother Nature. That best you can kind of, you know, come to a truce, maybe a standoff, Mexican standoff, but you can't really intervene and you can't really change your fate if the planet decides to throw what it's going to throw against you. Isn't that the basic story of the global superstorm?
Yes,
well, you get the hell out of the way, you can't do anything about it?
Yes, well, the archaeological side of it, I'm afraid, is on the side of this occurring.
But it doesn't say that you have to keep repeating the sins of the fathers. Maybe we can be smarter this time around. Maybe we can, you know, get enough people to take us seriously. And the cool part, Art, the part that David and I are 100% agreement on, is that we don't have to invent anything. Because we know from data that's leaked out in a variety of ways, and that piece of video that I, you know, gave to you, we know the Black Ops boys have all the necessary technology to at least begin to tackle the problem if they are of a mind to, and it's up to us to make them of a mind to.
David, do you agree with all of that for the most part? Or if you disagree, where?
I see that. For example, you've probably heard about this Area 51 scientist, Dr. Dan Borish. Right?
Yes, but I followed that trail, David, and I'm not at all satisfied with the genuine aspect of that trail.
I've talked to the people. You've got to hear where I was going.
I'd love to hear where you're going, and will in a second. I'm just telling you that I interviewed some people who were supposedly in communication with this man. And I did not find reliable or test-worthy any of what was said to me. But having said that, and I really wanted to say it, go ahead and say what you were going to say.
Well, I just wanted to point out that if anything of what he said is true, that an article that I wrote is one of only about two website links that he uses in his summaries. So what that kind of was a big event for me, because I realized if this guy is for real, then the stuff that Richard and I are working on is cutting edge even for them. So the intel that you and the audience are hearing tonight is as hot, as cutting edge, as fresh as if you were in Area 51 sitting in a small little briefing room and had access to this compartmentalized information. They don't know that the physics can make a difference. The three alternatives that they had are ridiculous. We're talking about like blowing holes in the atmosphere to let the heat out. All you have to do in order to understand how this physics works is basically get down to what's really happening at the quantum level. How is matter created?
Well,
gravity?
We're out here really dancing on the edge, in my opinion.
According to Gene Mayloff in that last conversation, and again, I'm thinking how incredibly prescient the things he said and the things I said in that last conversation, because where Gene was when he died is that current physics, including quantum mechanics, relativity, zero point, all of it is garbage. It's bunk. Complete garbage, Art. And what replaces it is something akin to what David and I have been talking about tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And this was from Mayloff himself. And the proof of this is in the experiments conducted by reputable, exquisitely genius-level people who have actual equipment and technology that is available to be seen on videos or in person and certainly funded for development and cannot get a dime of funding. In fact, his entreatment to me in our conversation was, "Dick, if you know of anybody who has an extra $10,000 or $20,000 to put into our nonprofit foundation so we can fund some of these critical experiments and keep these people alive, please let them know." And I said to him, and this is incredibly ironic, I said, "Gene, you need to come back on coast and tell the country yourself what you've got in that drawer." And he said, "I would love to." And of course, 2 days later, he can't do it.
All right, but it is important that we, I don't know. I felt when we started down the Burrish Trail, Richard, you've looked into that?
No, I have looked at Burrish, and I think it's complete disinformation.
Okay.
I think it is complete nonsense. It is more noise. It's like when you get to the end part of this game, Art.
Well, if you don't separate the noise,
you've got to separate it
from the signal, then you're not going anywhere.
That's right. And you've got to be very fine-tuned and know when your BS detector is really being tickled. And the Burrish thing to me, it reeks of disinformation.
Okay, we agree on that.
Apart from that, the fact that Maloff has stood behind in public some stunning technologies that go back to the work, I'll give you one example, of William Reich. Now, that's a name you should remember, Art.
Yes, of course.
William Reich was a medical doctor, and he got into something called orgone energy, which was never really understood. He tried to get Einstein to take it seriously, and there was some conversation there, and Einstein did not really duplicate a key experiment, and so ultimately passed. But the fact is that the people that Gene has worked with and the lab that he set up has done stunning confirmation of almost everything that William Reich wrote about. And you know what happened to Reich in the 1940s. They ultimately arrested him, locked him in prison, and killed him.
And, of course, Tesla. Tesla has to mix into all of this.
It's like the old joke about the guys, you know, all blind guys handling the elephant. One's got the trunk, one's got the leg, one's got the tail. We're all talking about the same stuff. It just has different names. And the stuff that Gene was talking about as the ultimate creator of reality, which goes from beagles to begonias. In other words, consciousness and life and biology and human beings and the spark of the soul that makes us alive and aware and questioning, as well as the sun and the galaxy and Andromeda and anything out there, it's all part of the same stuff, and that is this invisible, massless ether, which Gene said fundamentally can create anything under the right conditions, can reform reality in any form you want under the right conditions. And that, in turn, is modulated by the transfer between higher dimensions and this 3D reality.
All right. Gentlemen, hold tight. Richard C. Hoagland, David Wilcock, and truly a galaxy-like discussion. It comes again and again and again. I wonder if this next time we'll be able to do anything at all about it.
Out on the street, I was talking to a man. He said, so much, but there's nothing mine.
Once again, Richard C. Hoagland, David Wilcock. Gentlemen, welcome back. So I can buy a lot of this. As I said, the cyclical part seems real and supportable. Even the hyperdimensional energy, certainly the energy is real and probably supportable and maybe tappable. But, you know, then to extend out to where you've got this secret group of people who are realizing this catastrophic event's coming to Earth and they're going to escape in their spaceships to Mars or something, leaving us to our awful...
Well, fortunately, the model doesn't depend on the politics. You know, whether there are people that know or don't know is completely irrelevant to what we're figuring out.
What I can believe, Richard, is that people have certain financial interests, like oil, and the world economy such as it is.
Yeah, remember, the lie is different at every level.
That's
and for those people, that's their universe, and they will hang on to the last drop. And you know, $4 a gallon, how about $40 a gallon?
Yeah.
Now, that's the box we're in. How do we get out? We have two problems, a short-term problem and a long-term problem. The short-term problem is keeping civilization alive that we want to live in. The long-term problem is keeping the planet alive, but we want to live on. And the data that David and I have put together and we're posting on the web, and I think, David, we're going to have more than three parts to this.
Well,
it sounds like it.
You know, David, if what you said about the experiments in Russia is accurate, then the way to do it is to I don't know, in some manner, force this information to be more public to the degree that the larger institutions have no choice but to attempt to begin to duplicate it and break this out.
The good part is that there's a lot of honest guys in the government. I was there at the May 9th Disclosure Project event in 2001, which kind of got blown away by 911, but nonetheless, I was in that room with the closed executive summary briefing from members of Congress. I watched these guys giving standing ovations when hearing from Sergeant Clifford Stone some of the most wildly esoteric UFO data you could imagine. So there's a lot of people out there who are in positions of power where they can make a difference, and they honestly don't know about this stuff because it's not part of the regular legitimate government.
This is why I'm planning in the briefing that I'm going to do on the Hill to bring some of these technologies and, if necessary, some of the scientists to Washington to stand there with me. And Gene was going to be one of my prime witnesses. Well, there are a lot of others. Gene was a conduit. Gene was a nexus point. But Gene, fortunately, was not one of a kind.
Well, Gene is obviously no longer with us. That's the horrible news of the night,
but
folks.
The important thing
is... there's a device.
Knowing his integrity, I mean, I will send to you, because you obviously have been looking at this and wanting a real set of stuff to appear for a long time.
Oh, yes.
I will send you what he sent to me, which is his first-person technical and philosophical testimony of what he observed, the experiments, how it works, the technology demonstrated in front of him.
Do you have enough information, Richard, to be led back to this, to get this device?
I know who the people are. I've talked with them.
Can you make your way to this device?
I can probably, I'm going to call them, but maybe I shouldn't call them. Maybe I should physically go there. Because the last person I called, very nasty things happened to. So I may have to be a little smarter about it this time. But I know who they are, and I know what they've done, and I know the foundations it will rock if I can demonstrate to these people
in
Washington,
of course,
the honest people, which I totally agree with David, that regardless of whether there's a cabal or not, 99.99% of the system, Art, is completely ignorant of anything.
All right, David, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I've seen the film of the device that everybody is so hot for. When Dr. Greer is talking about seize power, SEAS, Space Energy Access
Systems. He's been hot on it for a while.
It's probably the same one that Dr. Eugene Maloff was talking about.
No, it's not.
Well,
this one works.
Well, that's the thing. I just wanted to say that I saw a film.
And this
of
is
a
not
guy.
Just a device. It is a physics of a multiple series of devices, including Art. One that produces anti-gravitational effects.
Are you two talking about the same device?
No.
Let me get this out. The one that I saw was a half a sphere, and it had an outlet, a regular ordinary 120-volt AC outlet on it.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was able to start his car with it, and he was able to power a lamp and do anything that you'd normally do with a regular outlet. Now,
It's not the same.
Okay.
One I'm thinking of is a motor, Art, and get this, the motor is not connected to anything. It just sits in empty space, and it spins, and when you touch it as a human being, it spins faster.
Yeah.
Because the physics is a physics of life. Remember the old Victorian idea of the vital force, the life force?
Yes.
That's why biology on this planet appeared at a certain time, half a billion years ago, after certain things happened on the Earth that had not happened in 3.5 billion years before. It's because biology and consciousness are part of this physics, which brings me to something very important. You have conducted yourself, my friend, 7, count the number, tetrahedral 7, fundamental consciousness experiments.
Yes.
Great experiment.
And one of those saved my life.
Yep.
As we recounted the other night with George when Robin was on as a guest. Without that intrusion into my situation, I did not know at the time, and no one has known, so we're going to tell your audience tonight, the doctors had in essence written me off.
Yep.
They basically told her I was toast. They didn't tell me, but they told her. So she moved heaven and earth with all the supplements and all the other things, and did her part of this miracle. But the other part, Art, that I really cannot discount, because I could feel it, there was an actual palpable change in how I felt. And believe me, when you're dying, you're very sensitive to how you feel.
Yeah, the other subjects of this experiment said these exact same words.
Okay, when you focus the consciousness of, I don't know how many of the millions of people who are listening to us tonight, unbelieving of many of the things we've been saying, when you focus all those people on me to get well, it changed. something changed. In fact, it changed so dramatically that some of my enemies put things on web. Remember that?
Yes, Richard.
Now, here's where it gets important.
I know it works.
Let me finish.
I know it works.
Okay, so if it works, and we're dealing with a ruffled physics, a out of tune, a dissonant, think of those fingers on the blackboard, everybody, that awful sound you used to hear in school that would make your teeth crawl and you jump out of your seat.
Yeah.
Think of that magnified 100 billion times, and that's what the world feels, and it tips over. But the antidote is maybe not just technology, maybe not gadgets, maybe not machines, maybe not what Gene was looking at, but what Art Bell has been doing, which is to focus people's energies, their concentration,
maybe,
on smoothing out the rough edges and moving us through this perilous time in a coherent, musical, coherent fashion, a harmonious transition as opposed to a discordant transition. It could be as simple, Art, as getting this audience to focus on a future they really want to happen, not the one they're afraid will happen.
I'm real glad to hear Richard Hoagland say that.
Well,
because there is a unity between the physics and consciousness and life. That's what the bottom line of this research has proven now to my satisfaction.
Well, I'm glad you're satisfied because I've been saying that for a long time. I wanted to check out one more pyramid thing because it totally ties in with what you just said. This one came from the Russian National Academy of Science, and they just took ordinary salt and pepper and stuck it inside the pyramid. They then removed it and fed it surreptitiously to about 5,000 people in certain selected jails in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly, within a few months, there was a dramatic improvement in the behavior of the guys in the jails. Most of the criminal behavior almost completely disappeared. Alcoholism disappeared, whereas in the control jails, there was no sign of any behavioral change. Nothing in the jails under this study had changed except that the salt and pepper from the pyramids was being secretly added to their food. So if the energy from the pyramid harnesses and focalizes this energy of consciousness, if the pyramid structure has sort of like a funnel effect for this fluid-like energy and can concentrate it, and if consciousness can move the energy the same way, then what if each person is sort of like a little portable Stargate, and the reason why we're having so much trouble has to do with people's inability to be honest with themselves, honest with each other, then their own internal shadow side gets projected out into the collective, so you get the shadow of each person being acted out in these occult politics. And when we get right with ourselves inside, the whole hologram changes. So I do have a portion of my work that focuses extensively on what we can do just in terms of getting to know ourselves better and basically just being nice to people and the difference that that can really make. Meditating for world peace can decrease the crime in a given city by 76%. That was the Maharishi effect.
The numbers are there. The studies are there, yes.
It's true.
Now, remember Bob's fast blast a few hours ago where he asked, is the problem, you know, in ourselves?
Yes.
And not the universe?
Yes.
The answer is yes. We are part of the broken physics of this system. The difference is the planet can't change itself because it's not conscious. We are conscious. We can control this dynamic, and you and I have lived through these experiments. Remember our Princeton colleagues and their little eggs, right?
Yep. Clearly.
We know that if we harness the combined good, positive energies of enough people, miracles, what anybody else would define as a miracle, can happen. I am literally tonight talking to you, Art, because I'm living proof of your faith and confidence in people to make a difference in my life.
Absolutely.
Well, I've seen this power work, so I know it works. I'm pretty well beyond that. I have no greater understanding of this power and the possible consequences of its use than I had then. I don't understand it, and so I'm very hesitant to toy with what I don't understand. Once I realized it, oh gosh, you know, hey, this really is a power. This really does work. Once that hit me like a brick, then it slowed me down because I began to tell myself, I don't understand what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing, and there is a law of unintended consequences. There's also, I suppose, a time when things are so serious that you don't have much to lose.
You got it. When the cliff is behind you and,
yes.
the thing is in front of you and
yes.
you've got to make the decision. But you
yes.
have now demonstrated seven times that this, in a proper moral atmosphere, can produce important miracles. And you've intervened in people's lives, my friend. You intervened in my life. And I believe firmly that I am here tonight in part because of what you were able to get this collective consciousness of all those people out there to
mm-hmm.
focus on, which is to keep me around so I can be a thorn in your side for a few more years.
Now, if we get the disclosure of this technology, it can't but only add to the way that people are going to open up and change, and that will change the physics. So it's like you teach people the physics, and the physics changes.
See, this is one reason I think why certain of these discoveries are suppressed. Not so much because of the technical or technological aspects of what they will make possible, but because of the incredible liberating effects on consciousness.
Correct.
We are our own worst enemies. We have trapped ourselves within this prison, and all we see played out on CNN are endless tape loops of horror and destruction and degradation and perdition and every possible vile thing you can imagine ramped up to a crescendo where people either turn off or tune out or go crazy.
If it bleeds, it leads.
So
oh, yeah.
The antidote is to provide people with hope, with a capital H. And there's something going to happen in our arena this summer, and Linda Moulton Howe, God bless her, is the first person to give us real information and intelligence on this. She interviewed one of the senior scientists on the Mars Express mission. And Whitley was talking to you the other night about this, remember?
Oh, yes.
How she said that, and I went to her website, and I'm going to link to a story we're doing on this, you know, after David and I, you know, have finished with this program tonight. But she interviewed this guy who was the chief scientist on the spectrometer on the Mars Express spacecraft, and he came within a whisker, within a hair's breadth, of admitting he's found benzene, formaldehyde, and other organic molecules produced only by life because they disappear in the Mars atmosphere in hours unless they're replaced. And he plans to announce his firm findings either in July, across, by the way, David, the canonical July 20th date,
uh-huh.
the Coast Bar meeting, the sacred Egyptian ritual date of July 20th,
mm-hmm.
or at the September meeting later in the fall just before the American election. What he's going to announce is that these molecules have been found, they've been confirmed, and they prove conclusively, because they can't be there otherwise, that there's current life on Mars. Art, when that happens, and this is what I was telling Gene, and we had such joy sharing our positive outcomes now that we've gone through the vineyards and labored for so long to see light at the end of this tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Gene, when that happens, he said, you don't have to tell me, Dick, he said, all kinds of other paradigms will come marching through that door,
yep.
and things people thought were impossible, outrageous, nonsense, bunk, pseudoscience will suddenly have to be taken seriously, and the media will become our friend because they'll be avidly following up on the stories of all the other discoveries that nobody thought were true that turn out to be true. And that, by the way, is the title of my talk on Capitol Hill, Life on Mars and Other Fantasies That Are Real.
Well, that should get their attention.
Part of the fulfillment of the prophecies. I mean, there are all these prophecies that talk about the kind of conditions we're going through right now.
There are.
And they describe a massive change in the whole way in which society functions and how people think about themselves.
They do.
And
yeah, I'm a great believer in free will. And I've gotten a lot of metaphysical stuff under my belt over the last 20 years in doing this and pursuing this. And I really believe, David, that if we were doomed, if we were condemned to do what the previous generations
uh-huh.
were condemned to, we wouldn't be given these choices.
Yeah, why would there be a prophecy?
The opposition is fighting so hard to keep us from figuring it out, because if we figure it out, we get enough people to join with us, we can make a difference.
Well, what
and
I'm
that's
hoping,
what Gene died believing.
What I'm hoping is that by a strict political expediency, the number of people who know about this becomes too great that even if somebody does want to suppress it, they basically can't in order to save face. That's what needs to happen. And the way we're going to do that is by getting the people who can get the message out to the people aware of how simple this is, aware that the whole entire solar system is changing in very obvious ways, if this movie, Day After Tomorrow, can help kickstart that whole thing and get people talking about this stuff, they can segue right into what we're doing right now. All NASA scientists, all mainstream, nothing fringe, nothing Russian, straight-ahead science that says the solar system is changing, and then we need to learn about the physics to figure out what we can do to get through this more smoothly.
Well, I think that's the biggest thing you've said tonight, to document the changes going on all around us. That should have meaning. Richard, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you, Art. I have one little surprise for you.
Very quickly.
Fox has invited Robin and me to be with you at the premiere.
All right.
We will see you in New York, my friend.
Congratulations.
All right. Congratulations, Richard. See you in New York.
Good night, David.
Good night.
Hi, Richard. Good night, Art.
Good night. Richard C. Hoagland, David Wilcock, and there you have it. Well, everybody, see you tomorrow night. And tomorrow night, another advocate of multiple dimensions, the incredible Dr. Michio Kaku. For me, and for all those who help bring this program to you, from the high desert, Nighthawk.